So if you want to join me in Matthew chapter 9, if you have a Bible. If you're visiting, our practice here is to teach through the scriptures chapter by chapter, verse by verse, cover the whole thing. Sunday mornings we're going through the book of Matthew, and I enjoy going through the Gospels on Sunday morning and into Acts and back into the Gospels because we are, if we're followers of Christ, should be looking at the life of Christ to understand who he is and who we are and how we should be living. We're picking up. We left off this last week in Matthew 9 around verse 17 or 18. Find it. Last week we covered the call of Matthew, the tax collector hated by his countrymen. They called him a publican. The publicans were notoriously crooked to the point where they were pretty much excommunicated from the nation and from the church and from the temple. And they were so dishonest that they weren't even allowed to testify in court. That's what people thought of them. They were, whenever you read about the publicans, they're usually lumped together with the publicans and the prostitutes, or publicans and the sinners. Those are the only people who would hang out with them. And Matthew was one of them. And Jesus came along and said, "Follow me." And Matthew, who was a religious man, his surname had been Levi, brought up a Levite, obviously from what he wrote in the book of Matthew, very well versed in the Old Testament. He quotes it about 100 times in his book. Finally saw something in Jesus that was different than the hypocrisy that he had seen growing up in the Jewish religion. And so he left everything and he followed him and held a party at his house, invited all his friends to meet Jesus. Of course, the religious folk looked at him and said, "What are you doing hanging out with these people?" And Jesus said, "Don't you understand that the healthy people don't need a physician, the sick ones do?" And he basically said, "I'm on a house call. I'm here to address their need." Of course, the people who were asking the question had the same need. They just didn't realize it. And then people came to him, the disciples of John in verse 14, and they asked him, and they said, "Why is it the Pharisees and John's disciples fast often? They go a day without eating." The Pharisees, we read in Luke and another place when one of the Pharisees prays, says that he fasts twice a week, two times a week he would not eat in an attempt to be more spiritual. John's disciples, of course, Jesus had said earlier in the Sermon on the Mount that there were hypocrites who fast, that they were doing it not to be right with God, but they made a point of making themselves look extremely miserable and telling everyone how much they were denying themselves to hear from God. And so they really weren't being spiritual. They were being hypocritical in what they were doing outwardly. John's disciples, on the other hand, they also fasted, but they were not. They were truly repentant, and John living a very austere lifestyle out in the wilderness, eating bugs and honey and dressed in rough clothing. And yet they see Jesus and they say, "Why is it that your disciples, you're always eating? You're always at a party. Everybody invites you over to dinner. You guys are eating, you're drinking, you have a great old time. How come you're not fasting like the other religious folk?" And Jesus said, "Hey, when the bridegroom is around, the wedding party can't be mourning. That's a time to celebrate. Their time of mourning will come when I'll be taken away." And then he said, and he was speaking of the religious system, "No man putteth a piece of new cloth on an old garment, for that which is put in to fill it up taketh away from the garment, and the rent is made worse." And he basically said, look, you can't come and when you have a hole in your jeans, you can't take a cut from a new piece of cloth and sew that on, because when you wash the thing and the patch shrinks, it will tear and make the thing worse. And in the same way, I didn't come to patch an old religious system. This is something different. This is something new. That was by works, by keeping the law. I've come to show grace. And those two things aren't You can't have both. You are either right with God because you keep his law perfectly by always doing everything right your entire life, which no one has done, or you're right with him through grace, through faith in Christ, that Jesus did it right in you believing in him and his death in our place. You get the righteousness that he earned. But you can't have both. It's not, well, it's Jesus and I do good things so that God likes me. You can't do good things for God to love you any more than he does. It says he so loved the world that he sent his only begotten son. So, and he's saying, I didn't come to patch that up. And then he talked about wineskins. He says, neither do men put new wine into old bottles, else the bottles break and the wine runs out and the bottles perish. But they put new wine into new bottles that both are preserved. Wine skin, when they made new wine, they dump it into a bottle made of skin. And as skin, you know, skin is stretchy, as the wine fermented and the gas grew inside the container, the skin would stretch with it and it would hold the wine. But then if you use that wine and then you want to make more wine and you poured in new wine into that old skin, the skin had lost its elasticity. And if it began to ferment again, it would break and both would be lost. And so he says, no, when new wine is poured out, it's put into a new skin because the old one can't contain it. Again, speaking of a change in the religious system. And in verse 18, where we pick up, it says, while he spake these things unto them, behold, there came a certain ruler and worshipped him, saying, my daughter is even now dead, but come and lay thy hand upon her, and she shall live. To really understand what happens in these next two statements, Matthew highlights certain parts of these stories. We're going to see two people. One is Jairus, whose daughter is very sick. The other one is a woman, we don't have her name, who's been bleeding for 12 years, and their stories kind of intersect. They come to Jesus at the same time. Mark and Luke also give accounts of this and fill in some details that Matthew leaves out. Luke chapter 8, verse 41, this is how the same passage starts there. It says, behold, there came a man named Jairus, and he was a ruler of the synagogue. And he fell down at Jesus' feet and besought him that he would come into his house, for he had one only daughter, about 12 years of age, and she lay a dying. But as he went, the people thronged him. A guy named Jairus, his name means whom God enlightens, and he is going to be enlightened. Luke tells us that he was a ruler of the synagogue. The Jewish people, when they came into the land, they originally worshiped God at the tabernacle. It was the one place where God had given Moses the directions on how to build this. It was a tent. There was the ark. Those of you who saw Indiana Jones, Raiders of the Lost Ark, it had, you know, the gold box. That was where his presence would be. Eventually, under Solomon, a temple was built in place of that tent, and that's the place where people went to worship. But Israel as a nation turned away. Eventually, the northern tribes were carried off into captivity, never to return. And then Judah and Benjamin in the south were conquered by Nebuchadnezzar, and the whole people were hauled off to Babylon. And they were there for 70 years. And while they were in Babylon, the Jews found themselves in a place where they had no way to worship the way they'd been instructed. They were supposed to go to the temple. They were supposed to offer an animal sacrifice as a covering for sin. When you don't have a temple and you don't have the ability to make your sacrifices, they realized, we've got to do something. What do we do? And what they did is they constructed synagogues in the areas where they lived in Babylon. In a synagogue, wherever there was at least 10 Jewish males, they would build a building. Originally, some of it was in houses, but sometimes they would build a place, and they would go there to meet. Different times, different people would speak. They'd read from the law. Each synagogue would have the scrolls, the copies of the Old Testament scriptures that were available at the time. They would go there to pray, and this man Jairus was a ruler of one of those synagogues. When they came back into the land, after 70 years they left Babylon, they came back, they continued that practice, and they had synagogues built around. Jairus was a ruler of the synagogue. The ruler of the synagogue, they operate a lot like churches do, in that most churches have various people serving in various ways. Some people have responsibilities, custodian-type responsibilities. They're the guys who take care of the grounds, they work the door, they make sure there's oil in the tank, and there's the lights are on and those things. They take care of the physical needs of the church. The ruler of the synagogue would be that guy. But he not only would he be involved in physical things, he also would handle some of the order of service. One of the things that they would do is there would be various rabbis or teachers who would travel around and teach the people. Jesus was one of them, and he was often invited to speak at synagogues. It was the ruler of the synagogue who would invite the traveling rabbis to come in and speak. He'd be the one that would kind of oversee the order of service and make sure nobody got weird, as people sometimes are wont to do in churches, get weird. That was his job. He was an important guy. It was an elected position. He was a respectable man, usually to be voted to a position in a church that does voting, you need to be a religious person, and certainly Jairus was that. As the ruler of the synagogue, he was most likely familiar with Jesus because Jesus had been going around and he'd been teaching. And we'd read earlier where when he taught, people were blown away by the way that he taught. And they said, there's something different about this guy. He's not like the scribes and the other religious folk that we've heard, because he teaches with authority. Like, he actually knows what he's talking about. So this man, Jairus, has a daughter. His one and only daughter, and she's about 12 years of age. I have three daughters, one of them who was recently 12. She's a little older than that now. Any of you who have children understand what it's like to have a child in the home. Everything changes from the day that you get to bring that little baby home. I remember going to the hospital, and, you know, we had been through Lamaze class, which was an experience I never wanted to go through again. We had what to expect when you're expecting, and then what to expect the first year, so we'd know what to expect, what to look for, and somebody who's been through this multiple times wrote us some advice, because you don't know. I mean, I really had much more preparation to drive a car than I ever did to take a baby home from the hospital. I felt like, don't I have to have a license? Are they going to ask me for this? And we go through, and the doctors help deliver my child, and that was, for my oldest daughter, that was an adventure in and of itself. It was complicated. And she's continued to be complicated ever since, but not that way, thankfully. But you bring that child home, and the home takes on a life it never had before. Children stretch you, certainly. I spent many nights rocking back and forth, standing in her room as she screamed into my face. Any adult treated me like that, they'd be out of my life. I wouldn't put up with that for a second, but with a child, something happens. Mama changes. She becomes Mama Bear. You don't mess with my baby. And you buy things you never thought you'd buy, and you're going into baby aisles and looking at clothes and bottles and car seats and, you know. And then they grow, and they run around the house, and then they begin to talk, and it changes everything. And this guy had one daughter. She was the light of his life, no doubt. But she got sick. We don't know exactly what she had. As Luke said, she lay a dying. In Mark's account, in Mark 22, Mark 20, chapter 5, verse 23, it says this, "My little daughter lieth at the point of death." You know they're desperate. You know Jairus' wife is desperate. At this point, Jesus had been to the synagogues. He'd done some things in the synagogues that the religious people didn't like. Quite possible that Jairus was there when Jesus had healed the man with a withered hand on the Sabbath. The religious leaders, believing that the Sabbath was a day where you should do no work, and that included healing somebody, and Jesus was quite upset about that, that there would be somebody who had been sick, and that the religious people, who should be concerned about people, instead were more concerned about their day, and they were angry that Jesus would have the audacity to actually heal somebody on the wrong day. So they didn't like him. Most likely, Jairus, as a respectable religious man, respectable religious men congregate together and talk, and you don't have anything to do with that, Jesus. He's bad news. But yet everybody's talking about what he's doing because he's healing people and he's healing lepers, which nobody has ever done. And he's giving the blind their sight and the lame people are walking and all manner of illnesses are being healed. And then Jairus' daughter gets sick. And you know his wife. I mean, he's going and he does what all of us do when one of our children gets sick. We find a doctor. We find somebody to help. Doesn't matter, day or night. If the hospital isn't around, you call a doctor you might know. You do whatever you have to do to try to get your daughter taken care of. The problem is there's nobody who can take care of her or help her. And it's getting worse, and it's getting desperate. And his wife, if he's anything like our wives, I'm sure, is saying, you need to go see this Jesus guy. But you don't understand. I can't have anything to do with him. But you don't understand. This is my daughter. And that fight is going on. And finally, it gets to the point where Jairus has nowhere else to turn. And so he comes when she's at the very point of death. It says there in Matthew 9:18 that he worshipped him. And it literally means he fell down at his feet. And he says, she's even now, she's at the point of death. Come and lay your hand upon her and she shall live. And Jesus arose and said, oh, now you need me. Didn't need me before, didn't like me before, but now that you're in a bind, huh? Is that the way it is, Mr. Holy Man? No, he didn't say that at all. I probably would have said that. Jesus didn't say that. It said Jesus arose and he followed him, and so did his disciples. The religious man who had position and he had respect got to the place where he realized he was powerless to help his daughter. And he knew somebody wasn't, and so he went, and he humbled himself. And many of us have this idea that if we've been at enmity with God, if we have been not living with him the way we should, that if we do want to go to him, that's the way he's going to be. Oh, come to me now that you're in a bind, huh? When the truth is, I think a lot of times he lets us get in a bind so that we will come to him. Because the way our lives normally work is when everything is going smooth, we get very preoccupied with ourselves and our life. And it's not until things get very difficult that we cry out. And he wants us to cry out. And so when Jairus finally gets to the point where he doesn't care about his position, he doesn't care about his religion, he cares about getting health and getting life for his daughter, Jesus arises and he follows him and he brings his disciples. Now Luke 8:42. Again, we read this earlier. It says, as he went, the people thronged him. Because he'd been healing people, and he'd been doing miracles, and he'd been teaching. So whenever he went anywhere, the place was packed. We covered, was it last week? We covered the guy who was sick of the palsy, and he was in a house, and they actually had to rip the roof off to lower this guy down because they couldn't even get near the door. Anywhere he went, he was crushed with people. Everybody who was sick wanted to be healed showed up. Everybody who wanted to hear something different than what they'd been taught all along about religion showed up, and there was just a press and a throng. And now, as he's on his way to Jairus, with Jairus, the people are mobbing him. There's no ambulance. There's no flashing lights. And understand where Jairus is at. Any of you ever made that trip with a very sick child to the hospital? For me, most of the traffic laws become optional at that point. I have to weigh it out, and I say, do I want to make sure that I don't roll through a stop line and just stop sign, or do I want to get my child to the hospital? If my child needs necessary medical attention, I'm going to get him there. Write me the ticket. I'll mail you the price. I don't care. I'm getting there. There's a friend I used to work with just had a daughter that got very sick recently, and she was in Millinocket, and he told me, he said, I think it's got to be some kind of record. I mean, she was on the point of death. He made it from the hospital in Millinocket to Eastern Maine Medical Center in 37 minutes. I don't even know if his car touched the ground, but I don't blame him because, I mean, you know, when the ambulance takes your daughter away doing 100 miles an hour with the lights flashing, you figure this is probably serious. I'd better follow. And so he just went for it. Jairus wants to do that same thing. But there's a mob of people who don't know the story, and they just want to see Jesus. And so he is acting, I'm sure, like that lead blocker, pushing people out of the way so I can get him to my house. I just have to get him to my house to save my daughter. She's at the point of death. She lays dying. So he's desperate to get there. And it says, and behold, a woman, check it out. That's what behold means. Matthew says, check it out. A woman which was diseased with an issue of blood 12 years came behind him and touched the hem of his garment. For she said within herself, if I may but touch his garment, I shall be whole. Interesting. Jairus had a daughter who had been the light of his life and had been his joy for 12 years, and now she was sick and he desperately needed her fixed. This woman had been sick for 12 years with an issue of blood. An issue of blood. She was bleeding. It was her menstrual cycle that never stopped for 12 years. The Old Testament law, Leviticus 15, they believed a lot in cleanliness. The law had been given by God, and part of the Old Testament law was about the things that made you defiled. And when you were defiled, you were supposed to be away from people, you were supposed to not go into the temple to worship. God was making a point through much of his law that he's a holy God, he's a righteous God, and that anyone coming to that God must be clean. And so there were things that you couldn't touch. You couldn't touch a dead body. That would make you unclean. And if you touched a dead body, you needed to go away. You need to go through some purification, some, you know, ritual cleansings and everything before you would be declared clean. Then you could come back into fellowship. Blood was one of those things that you were not allowed to touch. So for a woman who's bleeding, she's unclean. This woman has been bleeding for 12 years. She's anemic. She's weak. Unfortunately, religion of that day believed that if that had happened to a woman, if she had that affliction, it was a moral problem. It was a result of God striking her. She had been immoral, and he had done this so that everybody who didn't know about her sin would know about it, and she'd be made unclean and put out. If she'd been married, her husband would have divorced her. She wouldn't be allowed to worship. Go to the temple. She wouldn't be allowed to be around people. If she had kids, they wouldn't be sitting on her lap and playing with her. None of that. She's not supposed to be touching anyone because she's unclean. For 12 years, she had been cast out. For 12 years, Jairus had been in the synagogue, a man of respect, full of religion. His daughter was the light of his life. Now all of a sudden, he's in a crisis. For 12 years, she had been an outcast. The only thing religion could do for her was point at her and say unclean. Now, there were some religious prescriptions for someone who had that. The Talmud, the Jewish commentary on the law, had some prescriptions in it of things to do if someone had what they called the bloody flux, if they were bleeding. And they were pretty much what you'd expect for medicinal practices mixed with superstition from 2,000 years ago. Things like carrying around the ashes from an ostrich egg in a linen cloth and there were all kinds of different things they could drink. They were mixtures of wine and, most of it was really nasty. Some of them involved, you know, taking a particular thing and going to a crossroads and then having someone sneak up behind you and scare you, sort of like the hiccups, to drive it out of you, saying, arise from your bloody flux, you know, and it'd be like, oh, it stopped. Well, she tried all of that. And not only that, Luke, who was a doctor, says this in Luke 8:43, and a woman having an issue of blood 12 years, which had spent all her living upon physicians, neither could be healed of any. She had taken everything she had to try to get this fixed, and she'd gone to physicians, and Luke says none of them could heal her. Mark, who was not a doctor and a little more practical, says it this way, she had suffered many things from many physicians and had spent all that she had and was nothing better, but rather grew worse. Not only does Luke say that they didn't help her, Mark says, no, they made her worse. They took all her money. She'd suffered a lot of stuff. And any of you who've been to doctors, sometimes you suffer a lot of stuff. And she was no better for it. She was a religious outcast. And she said within herself, it's interesting, she's not telling anybody this. In fact, she's not supposed to be there in the crowd because anybody who would bump against her, if it was found out that they had touched her, they would be unclean and they would have to go away and be purified for a day or two. So she wouldn't be in a crowd. But she's hiding the fact that she's sick, and she says to herself, if I can just touch the hem of his garment, I'll be healed. Why would she say, if I could just touch the hem of his garment? You know, they wore robes in that day, and she said, if I can just grab the border of that garment, I'll be made whole. He hadn't healed anybody else with the border of his garment. Well, in the Old Testament, in Numbers chapter 15, this is one of the things that Moses had written. In verse 37 of Numbers 15, the Lord spake unto Moses, saying, "Speak unto the children of Israel, and bid them that they make fringes in the borders of their garments throughout their generations, and that they put upon the fringe of the borders a ribbon of blue. And it shall be unto you for a fringe, that you may look upon it and remember all the commandments of the Lord and do them, and that you seek not after your own heart and your own eyes, after which you go a cheating, that you may remember and do all of my commandments and be holy unto your God. I am the Lord your God, which brought you out of the land of Egypt to be your God. I am the Lord your God." They were commanded, the men, to take their garments and put a ribbon of blue along the fringes of their garments, and it would be a reminder. Anytime they saw that ribbon of blue, they're supposed to think, the Lord commanded us to do that as a reminder, kind of like tying a string around your finger. You ever do that? You'd leave yourself a note. I do that sometimes. If I'm supposed to pick something up on the way home, I'll put a sticky in my car over my speedometer because I figure I got to look at that sometime and I'll remember. I tie something on and then you see that and you think, why did I tie that there? I know there's a reason. And then I ask my wife and she tells me. But they were to tie a ribbon of blue around their garment to remember that they were supposed to know the word of the Lord and do it because he was a holy God and they weren't supposed to seek after their own things and what they wanted. So that was the practice. In fact, it had become a practice of the religious folk to a huge degree. In Matthew chapter 23, verse 5, Jesus is going to say, "But all of their works they do for to be seen of men. They make broad their phylacteries and they enlarge the borders of their garments. They do what we do. Oh, it makes you holy? It's a reminder of holiness to put a little bit of blue on the hem of my garment? Well, I'm really holy. I better have a big patch, you know." So they'd have big fancy blue ones. And so that everyone would say, "Ooh, look at that. He must be really holy. He must really be something." Jesus, no doubt, had a ribbon of blue around his garment because that was commanded in the law and he kept the law perfectly. I would imagine it was the standard stock, whatever you get at Walmart, ribbon of blue you put on your garment. He was a carpenter. He didn't have anything fancy. He had what the law required, no more, no less. But I think this woman, who had spent a lot of time dealing with priests and religious folk, trying to be fixed and also being told that she was unfixable and an outcast, had heard something about this Jesus and understood this is a different guy. And of all the ones that I've ever heard of, I think he really does keep the scriptures. I think there is something about that ribbon of blue that shows that he is not going after his own way. He does know that the Lord is the Lord, the one who did the miracles and brought them out of the land of Egypt. And so you know what? I'm going to try for that hem of his garment. I'm going to try to get through the crowd, and if I can just touch that thing, I'll be made whole. Was that superstition on her part? Well, I don't know that she was completely doctrinally correct, but I don't think that really mattered a whole lot. I think the deal was she believed that Jesus was who he said he was. He was able to do what he said he could do. And if she could just somehow get a touch of that, she would be made whole. She says, "If I can just touch his garment, I shall be whole." Now, before we read verse 22, we should read what Luke says in 8:44. It says, "She came behind him and touched the border of his garment, and immediately her issue of blood stopped. And Jesus said, 'Who touched me?' When all denied, Peter and they that were with him said, 'Master, the multitude throng thee and press thee, and you say, who touched me?'" Jesus is in a crowd. Everybody's trying to get at Jesus. They all want to touch him. They all want to be near him. They all want to be seen of him. And in the middle of that, and it's just a packed bunch of people that Jairus is trying desperately to push, this woman manages to just touch the hem of his robe, and Jesus stops and says, "Who touched me?" And his disciples say, "Everybody. I mean, what do you mean, who touched you? You're in the middle of a mob. They all touched you, and those that can't are really trying." But Jesus said, "Somebody had touched me, for I perceive that virtue has gone out from me. I know that something happened." And when the woman saw that she was not hid, see, the problem is when an unclean woman touches a clean man, he becomes unclean. That's why that she wasn't supposed to be around them, because the religious people don't want to be touched because they don't want anything to interfere with their worship. God forbid they get touched by some nasty, sinful, unclean person and they're unable to worship for a day. That's why they kept her out. But Jesus is different than anybody else, because anyone else who is touched by something unclean becomes unclean. But Jesus, when he touches something unclean, it becomes clean. But she doesn't know that. She just wanted to be healed. And she knew she was healed. As soon as it happened, it was made whole. And this woman who was weak and anemic was suddenly back to full health again. And she knew it had stopped instantaneously. But he stops and he says, "Who touched me?" And now she's freaked out because she's thinking, "I made him unclean. I made the master unclean. They're going to stone me." But in verse 47 of Luke 8, it says, "And when the woman saw that she was not hid, she came trembling and falling down before him. She declared unto him before all the people for what cause she had touched him and how she was healed immediately." So she told the whole story. The whole 12-year story. Meanwhile, Jairus is saying, "My daughter is dying. This woman's been bleeding for 12 years. Couldn't she bleed for 15 more minutes? Okay? It hadn't killed her for 12 years. She probably can go 12 years in a day. Let's get to my daughter." But no, Jesus stops like he's got nothing else to do in the world but deal with this one woman. And she's deathly afraid, but she tells the truth, tells the whole story. In Matthew chapter 9, verse 22, Jesus turned about him, and when he saw her, he said, "Daughter, be of good comfort. Thy faith has made thee whole." And the woman was made whole from that hour. Daughter. This is the only woman in all of the Gospels that Jesus calls daughter. She's afraid, trembling. She's felt like she's been an outcast and unholy for 12 years. And Jesus says to her, "Be of good comfort." It's the same thing that he said to the guy sick with the palsy we covered before. He literally says, "You have nothing to fear. For me, there is nothing that you have to fear. You don't have to be afraid. Be of good comfort. Your faith has made you whole." Now in Luke 8, again to piece the story together, verse 49, it says, "And while he yet spake, there cometh one from the ruler of the synagogue's house, saying to him, Thy daughter is dead. Trouble not the master." He's dying to get on the road to get back to his daughter, and this lady's telling the story, and everybody's clapping, and it's a great, wonderful, teary moment, and he's just dying to get him there. And as Jesus is saying, "You have nothing to fear," somebody shows up from Jairus' home and says, "It's too late. She's dead. No sense dragging him to our house because it's over." And notice what Jesus does. When Jesus heard it, he answered him saying, "Fear not. Believe only, and she shall be made whole." Now, it's one thing to heal somebody who's sick. It's another thing to bring somebody back from the dead. People have been sick and they recovered. Sometimes even people die today on the table and they got the paddles right there and they can put the shock to them or jab a needle in their heart and revive them, give them some mouth-to-mouth. This girl's dead with no medical treatment in the Middle East, with no refrigeration, no sanitation. This servant has come from away to get her, to get Jairus and tell him that she's dead. He has nothing to go on. His hope is destroyed at that moment when the servant says, "She's dead." When Jesus hears that, he immediately turns to Jairus and he says, "Fear not. Just believe and she'll be made whole." So at this point, Jairus has nothing to go on but the word of the Lord that she will be healed. Nothing else. And when Jesus came into the ruler's house and saw the minstrels and the people making noise, he said unto them, "Give place, for the maid is not dead, but she sleepeth." And they laughed him to scorn. In that day, they had professional mourners. How many of you guys have been to a funeral over at Herbie Clay's before? Pretty much most everybody in the room has been there. Sometimes you go and the place is packed. Sometimes it's packed because everybody is really missing the person and really love them. Maybe sometimes it's packed because people are really happy that they're gone. I don't know, and it's a big party. But sometimes it's not that packed. There's only a few that show up, whether it was a stranger that not many people know or it was someone that nobody liked. Very small. They believed that the amount of grief that was shown was directly proportional to the importance of the person who had died. And so they hired mourners. They would hire people to come and play flutes and people to come and cry and wail to show, because death is a weird thing. Any of you ever been over there to a funeral? Have you, any of you ever been there and liked it? I haven't. And I've done a couple funerals there. And Hervey's a good guy, by the way, if you don't know him. He has a ministry that is, it's a strange one, but it's a very good one. Because that is a time when nobody is comfortable. When they're going through that, everything comes to a stop. It doesn't matter how life is going, how crazy your life is. When somebody dies, somebody you love, everything just gets really strange and you don't know which way to turn. And you need someone to help you deal with this. And he is able to do that very lovingly and very delicately. I've had a couple opportunities to talk with him at my father's funeral for one, and another one I did. And, you know, even preparing someone for burial in doing that, for him, that's one of the most loving things you can do. And I talked to him about it, and he it's funny, my first funeral that I had, I got to do, and it was a very privilege for me to be able to do it, even though it was hard, was for my dad. And even though it was very difficult to do, I was glad to do it because I love my dad and I wanted to send him home in a way that he deserved. Hervey told me that he had the opportunity, I believe, to do that for his mother, to prepare her to be buried. And it was a loving thing, even though it would be weird for us. It was a loving thing to do. And pray for that man, because he has a chance to talk to people when they are vulnerable, like at no other time in their life. But when death happens, you don't know what to do. Some people freak out. Some people get quiet. Some people laugh nervously. Some people want to ignore it and pretend it's not happening. There are ways to behave in our society. You know that? There's ways to behave in a movie theater. There's ways to behave in a restaurant. There's ways to behave in the grocery store. Don't take bites out of the food that are in the rack. I mean, everywhere has its rules. But in when it comes to death, there isn't a good set rule on how to behave. And I have never really met too many people who, well, maybe Hervey, but not too many other people who know how to behave in that environment, because I really think we're not wired for it. We are hardware that has software. And the software controls the hardware. My software knows what to do when I come into the grocery store. I've been taught that. My software knows what to do instinctively in some situations. You know, when something's hot, I pull away from it. When something's cold, I cover up. When it comes to death, nobody knows exactly what to do. And I think the reason why is we were never intended to experience death. Originally, there was no death. It wasn't until sin happened in the garden that Adam and Eve, their fellowship with God was cut off, and death came into the world through one man's sin. And because none of us were intended to deal with death, we're not programmed to know how to deal with death, so everybody kind of does their own little weird thing. But in that culture, the right thing to do was to wail. But some people can't wail when they're dead. They're just numb and they don't know what to do. So you hire somebody to wail for you. In fact, you hire a few and some pipers. And that way, when people come into this place and they're going to experience the shock of death and seeing someone they've loved dead, you have some people that are already crying to beat the band to kind of get the emotions rolling the way they're supposed to go, kind of prime the pump. And the more important they were, the more wailers you would have. And Jairus was an important man. So the professional mourners were, you know, and they're playing the mournful music. And when Jesus comes to the house, those people are going full bore. And he says to them, get out of the way. She's not dead. She's only asleep. And they laughed him to scorn. The professionals were going, she's dead, dude. I'm a professional. This is my third one today. She's as dead as they come, dead as a doornail. She's cold. She's stiff. She's dead. Telling me she's not dead. Come on, I do this for a living. But when the people were put forth, he kicked them out. The professionals were laughing at him. You know, it was really sincere, intense mourning when somebody goes from crying to laughing at you in the same sentence, scornfully laughing. And he kicked them out, and he took her by the hand. The other gospel said that he said to her, Talitha kumai, which means little maid, arise. And she woke up. Luke 8:54-55 says this. He put them all out. He took her by the hand and he said, maid, arise. And her spirit came again. And she arose straightway. And he commanded to give her meat. She's hungry. Give her something to eat. Now it said her spirit came again, which means her spirit left. Death is separation. It's the separation of your soul from you. You, this is not you. This is the container of you. You know, you are you. If you lose a finger or an arm or a leg, you're still you. You just have less container, but you haven't changed. When you die, your body dies, but you're eternal. We are eternal. And we're either going to be eternally with God in paradise, or we're going to be eternally separated from God in torment. And so this little girl, when Jesus said, arise, hears her voice, and she comes back. It happened a few times, not too many times. In Luke 7, there is the widow of Nain's son, funeral procession. They're carrying him to the tomb, and Jesus kind of interrupts it to make him get up. The other one is Lazarus. Lazarus is a friend of Jesus. He's sick, and then he dies, and then Jesus waits 4 days. He knows that he's at the point of death. And his disciple says, are we going to go to him? And Jesus says, oh, he sleepeth. And his disciple says, well, good. He must be getting better. He's resting. And Jesus says, no, you don't understand. He's dead. And he waits 4 days. Now, there's a reason why he waits 4 days. Any of you who have a medical background, I know some of you do, there's things that happen at death. When movement stops, decay begins immediately. I don't know the time frame. I'm sure some of you do intimately, of when the blood starts to separate and the heavier parts sink to the bottom, and the cells begin to deteriorate, and the soft organs begin to dissolve. 4 days, no refrigeration, no embalming, you're mush inside. Your eyes are gone, your liver's gone. This isn't resuscitation at that point. We can resuscitate somebody if they've been dead for a few minutes. Sometimes they fall into a lake, and for a few hours, you can bring them back. This is 4 days in the heat in the cave in the Middle East. He's like the meat that you left outside for a few days. He stinketh. That's when he get there. Jesus says, roll away the stone. And the friends say, Lord, he stinketh. You don't want to pull that back. That's not going to be pretty. But Jesus says, now he's asleep. He doesn't look at death the way we do. Because to him, it's just asleep. And you're going to get back up again. Now, Jairus was in agony for a period of time, however long the journey was, from when he finds out that his daughter is dead until he gets there. But he's had the word of Jesus saying that she's going to arise. So we had that to cling on to. And Jesus seems pretty intent that it's going to happen, so he follows him there. So it was maybe a couple hours. A widow of Nain's son, they usually buried him in the same day. So when he was raised up in the funeral procession, he'd probably been dead for a good part of a day. Lazarus, 4 days, and his sisters, Mary and Martha, whom Jesus was great friends with, when he got there, said, oh, Lord, if only you'd been here. But how different would the story have been if they'd have known from the beginning, he's going to get back up again. You know, Jairus, she's going to get up again. It's just an hour. I can deal with it for an hour. If I'm going to see her again, if it's only for an hour, I can do an hour. Or the widow of Nain, it's only going to be a better part of a day. Oh, well. You know, he goes to Bangor shopping for a day, and I don't see him for a day. That's no big deal. Lazarus, it's only going to be 4 days, and then he's going to get up again. He's going to get up in 4 days. Well, 4 days? I can, you know, sometimes I go on vacation for a few days, go to summer camp. I can be without my kid for 4 days. 4 days. Well, what if it was 4 weeks? What if Jesus said, Lazarus, he's going to get up again. It's going to be 4 weeks, but 4 weeks. Well, I could do 4 weeks. I mean, maybe it's like, or 4 months. Well, you know, those of us who have kids that go away to college or something, well, 4 months, it's a long time. But if I'm going to see him again in 4 months, the time will go quick. What if it was going to be 4 years? Matt and Missy, who we miss, are out in Arizona, going to be there for a few years. I keep telling him they need to repent and move back, but he's got a job out there. But if you know they're coming back, it's not that bad. It changes everything. The thing that makes death so difficult is we think it's over and I won't see him anymore. But if you know Jesus, they're just asleep. They're getting back up. This is what he says in 1 Thessalonians. Paul says, chapter 4, verse 13, I would not have you to be ignorant, brethren, concerning them which are asleep, that you sorrow not, even as others which have no hope. And he's talking about people who have died. For if we believe that Jesus died and rose again, even so, them also which sleep in Jesus will God bring with them. They're going to get up. For this we say unto you by the word of the Lord, that we which are alive and remain unto the coming of the Lord shall not prevent or go before them which are asleep. For the Lord himself shall descend from heaven with a shout, and the voice of the archangel, and with the trumpet of God, and the dead in Christ shall rise first. And then we which are alive and remain shall be caught up together with them into the clouds, and meet the Lord in the air. And so shall we ever be with the Lord, forever. They're only asleep for a little while. And then he says, wherefore, comfort one another with these words. It's been about 4 years since my father died, right around there. I miss him. But I know he's going to get back up. He loved the Lord. He died with a relationship with Christ. And he's not going to come up like some floating spirit, and I'm going to see him, and he's going to see me, and we're going to waft towards each other and drift through each other. Flesh, bone, new bodies, not fallen apart, wrinkled, not wasted away like I saw him before he died, but in the picture of health, forever to be with the Lord. Well, that changes everything. Then when you go to see Hervey Clay, it's not such a bad thing because it's only for a little while. And when they come back, they'll look way better than when we saw them the last time. The question is, you trust what Jesus said. The woman saw something different about her, something that religion could only make her think she was cast away and unclean and unfixable. But coming to Jesus, he can fix anybody. Jairus had religion, he had power, he had respect of people, but that did nothing for him when it came to the most awful foe of all, which is death. But Jesus says, that's nothing for me. She's going to wake back up. Do you have that hope? That this is not all there is? That those who fall asleep in the Lord will come back. If you don't have that assurance, you can have it. It doesn't matter what religious system you've been brought up in. It doesn't matter what set of rituals you follow. Jairus followed them all. The lady was excluded from all of them. But both of them came into contact with him and had their lives changed forever. If you have not done that, if you have not met the one that is the only one who's worth following, I would encourage you, see me afterwards, I'd be glad to pray with you. And you can start a relationship with the God who loved you so much that he died for you, so that you and I could wake up. Let's pray. Father, thank you so much, Lord, that you reach out to everyone. And you just say, don't fear, just have faith. Lord, I pray that you would work in our lives to live in such a way that we really believe that's true. Lord, not in deathly fear of what's to come, but Lord, in earnest expectation of seeing those ones again that we have lost. Lord, help us to treat this life like it really is temporary, and help us to focus on the one that's eternal, the one spent with you. I pray you would bless my brothers and sisters in Jesus' name. Amen. Grace and peace, guys.